Penguin Random House Audio presents The Professor's House by Willa Cather. Read for you by Sean Renette. A turquoise set in silver, wasn't it? Yes, a turquoise set in dull silver. Louis Marcellus. Book 1. The Family. Chapter 1. The moving was over and done. Professor St. Peter was alone in the dismantled house where he had lived ever since his marriage, where he had worked out his career and brought up his two daughters. It was almost as ugly as it is possible for a house to be. Square, three stories in height, painted the color of ashes. The front porch, just too narrow for comfort, with a slanting floor and sagging steps. As he walked slowly about the empty, echoing rooms on that bright September morning, the professor regarded thoughtfully the needless inconveniences he had put up with for so long. The stairs that were too steep, the halls that were too cramped, the awkward oak mantels with thick round posts crowned by bumptious wooden balls over green-tiled fireplaces. Certain wobbly stair treads, certain creaky boards in the upstairs hall, had made him wince many times a day for 20-odd years, and they still creaked and wobbled. He had a deft hand with tools. He could easily have fixed them. But there were always so many things to fix, and there was not time enough to go round. He went into the kitchen, where he had carpentered under a succession of cooks, went up to the bathroom on the second floor, where there was only a painted tin tub. The taps were so old that no plumber could ever screw them tight enough to stop the drip. The window could only be coaxed up and down by wriggling, and the doors of the linen closet didn't fit. He had sympathized with his daughter's dissatisfaction, though he could never quite agree with them that the bath should be the most attractive room in the house. He had spent the happiest years of his youth in a house at Versailles, where it distinctly was not, and he had known many charming people who had no bath at all. However, as his wife said, "If your country has contributed one thing at least to civilization, why not have it?" Many a night, after blowing out his study lamp, he had leaped into that tub, clad in his pajamas, to give it another coat of one of the many paints that were advertised to behave like porcelain, and didn't. The professor in pajamas was not an unpleasant sight. For looks, the fewer clothes he had on, the better. Anything that clung to his body showed it to be built upon extremely good bones, with the slender hips and springy shoulders of a tireless swimmer. Though he was born on Lake Michigan, of mixed stock, Canadian-French on one side and American farmers on the other, St. Peter was commonly said to look like a Spaniard. That was possibly because he had been in Spain a good deal and was an authority on certain phases of Spanish history. He had a long brown face with an oval chin over which he wore a close-trimmed Van Dyke, like a tuft of shiny black fur. With this silky, very black hair, he had a tawny skin with gold lights in it, a hawk nose and hawk-like eyes, brown and gold and green. They were set in ample cavities, with plenty of room to move about under thick, curly, black eyebrows that turned up sharply at the outer ends, like military mustaches. His wicked-looking eyebrows made his students call him Mephistopheles, and there was no evading the searching eyes underneath them, eyes that in a flash could pick out a friend or an unusual stranger from a throng. They had lost none of their fire. Though just now the man behind them was feeling a diminution of ardor. His daughter Kathleen, who had done several successful studies of him in watercolor, had once said, "The thing that really makes Papa handsome is the modeling of his head between the top of his ear and his crown. It is quite the best thing about him." That part of his head was high, polished, hard as bronze, and the close-growing black hair threw off a streak of light along the rounded ridge where the skull was fullest. The mold of his head on the side was so individual and definite, so far from casual, that it was more like a statue's head than a man's. From one of the dismantled windows, the professor happened to look out into his back garden, and at that cheerful sight he went quickly downstairs and escaped from the dusty air and brutal light of the empty rooms. His walled-in garden had been the comfort of his life, and it was the one thing his neighbors held against him. He started to make it soon after the birth of his first daughter, when his wife began to be unreasonable about his spending so much time at the lake and on the tennis court. In this undertaking, he got help and encouragement from his landlord, a retired German farmer, good-natured and lenient about everything but spending money. If the professor happened to have a new baby at home, or a faculty dinner, or an illness in the family, or any unusual expense, Appelhoff cheerfully waited for the rent. But pay for repairs he would not. When it was a question of the garden, however, the old man sometimes stretched a point. He helped his tenant with seeds and slips and sound advice, and with his twisted old back. He even spent a little money to bear half the expense of the stucco wall. The professor had succeeded in making a French garden in Hamilton. There was not a blade of grass. It was a tidy half-acre of glistening gravel and glistening shrubs and bright flowers. There were trees, of course, a spreading horse chestnut, a row of slender Lombardy poplars at the back along the white wall, and in the middle two symmetrical round-topped linden trees. Masses of greenbrier grew in the corners, the prickly stems interwoven and clipped until they were like great bushes. There was a bed for salad herbs. Salmon-pink geraniums dripped over the wall. The French marigolds and dahlias were just now at their best, such dahlias as no one else in Hamilton could grow. St. Peter had tended this bit of ground for over 20 years, and had got the upper hand of it. In the spring, when homesickness for other lands and the fret of things unaccomplished awoke, he worked off his discontent here. In the long hot summers when he could not go abroad, he stayed at home with his garden, sending his wife and daughters to Colorado to escape the humid prairie heat, so nourishing to wheat and corn, so exhausting to human beings. In those months when he was a bachelor again, he brought down his books and papers and worked in a deck chair under the linden trees, breakfasted and lunched, and had his tea in the garden. And it was there he and Tom Outland used to sit and talk half through the warm, soft nights. On this September morning, however, St. Peter knew that he could not evade the unpleasant effects of change by tarrying among his autumn flowers. He must plunge in like a man and get used to the feeling that under his workroom there was a dead, empty house. He broke off a geranium blossom, and with it still in his hand, went resolutely up two flights of stairs to the third floor, where, under the slope of the mansard roof, there was one room still furnished. That is, if it had ever been furnished. The low ceiling sloped down on three sides, the slant being interrupted on the east by a single square window, swinging outward on hinges and held ajar by a hook in the sill. This was the sole opening for light and air. Walls and ceiling alike were covered with a yellow paper, which had once been very ugly but had faded into inoffensive neutrality. The matting on the floor was worn and scratchy. Against the wall stood an old walnut table, with one leaf up, holding piles of orderly papers. Before it was a cane-backed office chair that turned on a screw. This dark den had for many years been the professor's study. Downstairs, off the back parlor, he had a show study, with roomy shelves where his library was housed, and a proper desk at which he wrote letters. But it was a sham. This was the place where he worked. And not he alone. For 3 weeks in the fall, and again 3 in the spring, he shared his cuddy with Augusta, the sewing woman, niece of his old landlord, a reliable, methodical spinster, a German Catholic, and very devout. Since Augusta finished her day's work at 5 o'clock, and the professor on weekdays worked here only at night, they did not elbow each other too much. Besides, neither was devoid of consideration. Every evening before she left, Augusta swept up the scraps from the floor, rolled her patterns, closed the sewing machine, and picked ravelings off the box couch so that there would be no threads to stick to the professor's old smoking jacket if he should happen to lie down for a moment in working hours.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?